Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join us for a captivating discussion as author Jason Wright teams up with Stephen Pritchard from the Blake Society to explore the transformative power of William Blake's work in modern mental health and addiction recovery. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this engaging event offers fresh perspectives on using historic literary insights to foster healing and growth in modern therapy.
Last year, somebody rang me up and said that they'd written a book. And the book was this book, Blake's Job, Adventures in Becoming. And it was Jason.
That'd be me.
Right, who I'll introduce. that would be you.
Yeah, exactly.
Except no substitute.
Oh, I remember. Yes, I did. Yeah.
You did. Yeah. And Jason said he'd written a book.
And might you be interested?
Yes. Yeah. And would we publicise it? And I went along to the book launch, and I was amazed to find out that Jason had been using Blake's illustrations to the Book of Job for some 30 years to facilitate the healing process for addicts of every kind. And I'd heard before people saying they were intending to use Blake's poetry for healing. In this case, it was the illustrations, and it wasn't an intention. Jason had actually been doing this for a very long time. And so, I was incredibly excited by that idea that Blake could take part in that healing process. He lives on. And I think many people find his poetry incredibly inspiring, and it has a healing effect, I think, as much poetry does. So Jason Wright, my friend here, is a transpersonal and psychoanalytic psychotherapist. And he worked with the Core Trust, which was a charity. He was CEO of that charity that was started to create holistic treatments for addiction. And you worked with them for some 12 years?
Yeah, I ran it for 12 years.
Jason was also involved in theatre for 12 years, which I think is relevant because a lot of your work is group work.
Yeah.
And that whole group dynamic. And I've worked with theatre and drama teaching, and so I understand how the one might translate into the other. And a lot of drama. Drama is always, in a sense, therapy for everybody involved, I think.
Same etymological root.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Jason's going to tell us about his book. Yeah. How did you come to write it, Jason, in the first place?
That was also a bit stupid, like the phone call. I spoke to one of the editors at Karnak Books, and said he was interested, a guy called Rod Tweedy, he was interested in Blake. And I said, I've been doing this with the illustrations of the Book of Job, kind of think it'll make a book. He said, yes, that's fantastic, commissioned me to do the book. And then I thought, I'll say a bit about Whitehead, we'll talk a bit about David Bohm, talk about Jung, which is how I trained. I'll come back to the self and the ego in a second in that context. And I've done in a year. 5 years later, almost bleeding to death, I get a first draft off the ground. Then that's reframed about three or four times. And then it finally comes together and arrives as a thing. The illustrations are all in place. So if I say a bit about Core was an extraordinary place. It's unfortunately since closed, which worked with people, I tend not to say addicts, I try and say people suffering with addiction, as a community, it was what was then used to be called a structured day program. So a group of about 20 or 30 people, and then probably 15 or 20 workers, voluntary complementary therapists, psychotherapists, group leaders, art therapists, drama therapists, all together, taking people through the point when they wanted to stop using through to the point when they were ready to return to the community. I did that most of the time. I was training as an analyst, and the training I did was in the tension between Jungian and classical psychoanalysis, but also quite broad, core was broad, so there was all sorts of different schools of psychotherapy and complementary therapies brought together as a community in core. And it was addressing and holding together the process that I try and articulate in the book, which is how you might see or understand the pursuit of addiction as some kind of life or spiritual path. I don't want to sound that overly inflated, but in order to resolve the problems that you need to resolve with addiction, you address and resolve, and Blake articulates this in the Job, the issues of living together as in a community, being an individual, but also being a part of a whole. So Core called itself holistic. That fits with a Jungian idea of addiction, which is the search for spirit in the wrong place.
And it's about very much, isn't it, the collective and the community in group work.
Yeah, so Core was about that. The book has taken that on a bit. There's a book by a Jungian analyst called Edward Edinger. Really short, quite interesting little book. Easy read, got the plates in it, where he talks about it being a confrontation between the ego and the self, which fits in Jungian terms, I'm going to use a technical term here, I'm sorry, called the transcendent function. So the way that Jung imagined that our becoming is that there's various different archetypal structures within an unconscious whole. The seat of the bit of us that is conscious and actually experiences the world is the ego, in a technical sense. Consciousness arises there, but all these unconscious archetypal components get expressed through that. The whole frame, the archetype of the whole frame, he called the self. And that was rooted in a collective unconscious, which he gave an there are all sorts of arguments about this, but he gave an a priori basis, so that it has a given collective becoming root to it, rather than necessarily being just socially negotiated. And then there's a tension between the two. So Edinger had used these plates to express how, and this is what Jung termed the transcendent function, there is a symbolic engagement between our conscious experience of life and our unconscious experience of life. And that when our conscious experience meets difficulty in, again, it's negotiable whether it is really real, but what we understand as reality, then a new symbol needs to form. But that process can be complex and difficult and a struggle. So these Job illustrations show that process. So Job's suffering in that context is the ego's search for a new symbol from the unconscious that incorporates both inner and external experience in a way that is knowable.
Yeah. Jason suggests that addiction is the symptom of our times. How you could think that, Jason, given the sort of the range of addictive drugs on offer, including alcohol, pornography, mobile phones, and so on. Social media. I just don't know.
Well, it could just be that I've spent a lot of time working with people who have addiction problems. So it's the corner of the world that I've inhabited. But it's not just that. There's a certain compulsive route to it. There is, I think, that separation from the whole, however one might construct and understand that or imagine that. And there's a search for it. So there's a process that you go through when you're working with someone who suffers with addiction, which actually is about more about ego formation and understanding and strengthening and, I would say, elasticizing that imaginal framework in our psyche to be able to then let go of it in a form that you can then become, I'm going to use David Bohm's language, coherent with a more unfolding process of wholeness. Now, I'm quite like the work I've done with a lot of the people that I've worked with, so I'm slightly idealized about it. But when they actually get it and get through it, There's an openness to someone who's experienced addiction at some depth that enables them really to be open to receiving and allowing the world to unfold, rather than having to egocentrically in some way impose on the world an idea of what it should be.
You used two terms, Jason, that for me really, you know, really worked with Blake, and Blake works with those ideas, although he doesn't necessarily use those terms. And you talk about the two states of exploitation or resonance.
Yeah. Okay. So that was I made that up. Got to say this somehow. I don't quite know how to say it. Exploitation was fairly straightforward. That's the world we live in at the moment. There's an I and there's a world, and I exploit it, and they're separate. I don't believe that's true. It's not actually my experience. You know, the more I live in that place, actually, the more unpleasant I feel. And that certainly wasn't the case working with. So we did group work. We tried to keep the people we worked with for anything up to 2 years. Of course, that became almost impossible to fund. Everybody was holding the frame for everybody. It was a co-creative and coherent process, not I do this to you. Soon as it got into, I had to do that, I had to start setting boundaries, we'd saw it was failing. You know, we'd agree boundaries, and we'd agree, which is like unbelievable with an addicts, because they're like unbelievable tricksters, they all know how to do a deal. But in that agreeing of the boundaries, you come to an agreed sense of why it might be there, why you might need a frame at all in order to, but the technical term I would use, contain your life. Bear your experience, allow those new symbols to become.
And exploitation applies equally to our relationships with each other,
yes,
and to our relationship to nature and the wider world, so that was
at root, is that, you know, there's 8 billion of us on the planet. We can't live like we did even in the 18th century. There aren't enough trees, or there aren't enough, you know, rare earth metals for my iPhone. But actually, if you then work, so Eleanor Ostrom is really useful on this. She works on the tragedy of the commons, that actually most religious frameworks organize themselves so that we become altruistic. Darwin was writing in the sixth iteration of The Origin of Species that actually evolution is altruistic at the level of the group, but then you have to move from that individual selfhood of exploitation to what I'm arguing is, the word I used is an experience of resonance. So rather than experience of exploitation, we're moving to an experience of resonance. And the book explains that on a group basis. So it takes you through both the plates and, unfortunately, some of the technical stuff, because I was writing it for psychotherapists, but I fill it with vignettes on a group and individual basis so that it shows you how people have gone through these experiences and where you get to at the end.
Shall we look at the Blake?
Oh, yeah, we can look at the plates. We're hoping
to have 15 minutes at the end.
So for you to ask questions. I'm happy to do some questions on the go, but I do want to also show you the plates. So that tends to slow things down. So this is the original plate. I get very anxious doing this, so I'm going to refer to my notes.
It's the frontispiece.
Can you see the red dot? These are the Elohim. I don't have a list in my head of who they are. The last one for Blake is Jesus Christ. For Blake, that's Jesus of the imagination, which for him is that connection to the whole, which I would see as numinous and divine. I don't make a separation particularly between a Christian metaphor or a Western metaphor and an Eastern metaphor, so the Buddhists would see that in terms of no self, but we haven't got 20 hours to argue through this.
Yeah.
Or indeed the rest of my life to argue what that is.
Blake refers to Jesus, the imagination,
exactly.
But he's also read the Bhagavad Gita, and says all religions are one. They're not all the same, but they're all from the same source.
There is a paper by a guy called Ferrara, I think it's Michael Ferrara, who makes a direct connection between Blake and Suzuki and Chan and Zen Buddhism, and says if you replace the word imagination with wisdom in Blake, you have the Chan Buddhist liturgy. Yeah. Anyway, so I better move on. This is the first image. So I refer to this as a status quo ante. In addictions terms, this is before you've started really properly getting into a habit. You can have a beer, it's all very lovely. Kathleen Rain talks about self-righteousness. So in Blake, the books are the dead letter of the law, and you haven't got any scrolls in this image, but I'll refer to them. Scrolls are the poetic truth, poetic genius. And at the bottom is the whole story of what he's writing about, is the letter killeth, the spirit giveth life. It's spiritually determined. You'll notice it's all very lovely. Job's having a great time. The instruments are in the tree, which you need to be suspicious of. The dog's asleep. The sheep are asleep. The sun is setting and the moon is rising. And they all think they're doing great. But Kathleen Rain talks about this as spiritual self-righteousness. So you're doing it on dogma alone. He had a big moment in Westminster Abbey, so he goes for the Gothic. He hates the materialists, so St. Paul's is the bad church and the Gothic church is the good church. So here we go. There are two versions of prints that he did. Of watercolours that he did. This is for Thomas Butts, who was the guy who showed up when he didn't have any clothes on, and are full of 18th century colours because that's all he could afford to do then. Then he met someone called John Linnell, and he did a set for John Linnell. They're 1805 and 1820, I think. And these are more, my wife's an artist, she pointed this out, these are more early 19th century colourings. Those paints were available.
Bright ones are really nice, aren't they?
You like those, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Their instruments are their hang-ups at this point, aren't they?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, so I'll say that this next, because I might not get set. The arts, music and poetry is how that engagement takes place. So when you're playing music, you're engaged in a whole process of natural becoming. Here, they're not. They're isolated, rational, I would say rational materialist. It's the deist church he fights, but he's a one-man war with rational materialism. That's Ian McGilchrist said that, not me, but I believe him. And so that's what the instruments in the tree are. This is, well, this is when Yahweh does the deal with Satan and says, so the story of Job, I'll tell really briefly, is that Job is the best of Yahweh, which is the God of I Am That, Yahweh's people. And Satan comes along and says, I can turn anyone. I can even turn him. And he goes, nah, you can't. And Satan says, well, of course I can. So he basically says, go on if you think you're hard enough, which is like slightly unfair. tad unreasonable. And Jung focuses on how then this is a kind of proto-Christian myth and points actually to the dark side, the difficult side, the broken side, what he calls the shards of God. Actually, if you follow the Jewish Kabbalistic tradition, God can be evil as well as good. Why would he not be all good? So that's the challenge that is happening here and is, in Jung's sense, what goes on as there is a search for a new symbol in the unconscious. You know, you actually have to change the whole framework of what you might imagine to be good and evil, which, of course, Blake challenges. So this is when it starts. There's a few things to say. It's in three frames. Blake is a Platonist. So not only did he say he met Plato and talked to him, but he hung out with a guy called Thomas Turvey.
Yes.
Major translator of Blake at the time, of Plato at the time. So he tends to frame things in not a straightforward Platonic way, but with four levels. So up here is Eden, where God is. Here is Beulah, which is the often is thought of as the dream life. That's like the soul that's in between heaven and earth. This is the world of generation, which is material reality. And then there's a fourth, which is Ulro, which we'll come to in a second. You can see a Kabbalistic reference here, which is there are the three trees of the tree of life. There's a vine running up it, which is Blake's image of interconnectedness. And then you see, he talks about the spectres. So Satan is the spectre of God. It's not exactly the same, but you can think of it as the Jungian idea of the shadow, that other part of us that has become neglected, that we've hidden and buried in the unconscious. And you can see here, Job and his wife as Shadow. I'm sorry if I have to rush.
A lot of Kabbalistic things going on throughout. Blake was very familiar with the Kabbalah. Thomas Taylor was the name.
Taylor.
A classicist was around.
So this is Ulro. I had to go through the whole book. I thought it was spiritual death. Then I had to go through the whole book and re-edit it and turn it to actually spiritual blindness, which is slightly more generous. And that was his attack on the Deist Church, which is materialist and rationalist, and God as a divine engineer, rather than some more numinous open hole beneath it. I think he was right about that. It was to do with what the Enlightenment was. Anyway, this is Satan at the top. Fire for Blake is transformative black. Fire, when it's really dark black, is felt as torture. So in kind of psychodynamic terms, that's when you take a symptom so far that it persecutes you, rather than being able to find a symbol within it that allows you somehow to change. And that's changing in that relationship between the internal and what you might understand the external world to be. I'm a bit ambivalent about what is really real, because that's quite a big question.
And if you know the tarot, this is reminiscent of the tower struck by lightning.
Okay, so you get an upside-down crucifixion here. This is the slain muse, and that would be poet. Some people think of that as poetic genius, which is where he picks up Swedenborg, the true man, the really true inner, to use a Winnicottian idea, true self. And you also begin to see it, the serpent appearing here. So this is distorted perspective. So, as you're using... That last plate was when it all starts to get a bit, what the 12 step is called, unmanageable. This is where you're beginning to head into complete denial. Your perspective is distorted. You're focusing on using. You'll tend to prioritize using rather than actually relating to your mates, which is what's underneath it. Satan is abroad in the world, is what is often said about this. And it's the point in the Job story where everything has been destroyed, his children have been killed, his crops have been destroyed, his house has burnt down, and everyone's coming to tell him that that's all a bit of a mess, and he's still praying to a God that's treating him terribly, or is seemingly treating him terribly appallingly. I like this one because the serpent is moving at the bottom, starting the real beginnings of the change off. But Yahweh... at the top up here, where are we? There we go. Seems almost to have, like, it's inevitable, really ambivalent look on Yahweh's face. And I can't focus in on these, but I try to when I'm doing this with a different presentation. Satan also is kind of like, do you really want me to do this? Anyway, the thinking around this is that Blake thought the ear was a spiritual organ, so all the horror and toxicity is being poured into his ear. It's a bit like auditory hallucinations, you might think of that, but it's not that simple. The actual plate is about hypocrisy. I think his name's Andrew Solomon, wrote a lovely little book about this. He calls this one hypocrisy. He's handing out alms. I've got to be, obviously, I've got something wrong. I've got to be a good boy. But to, you know, the dog's quite happy. The beggar looks kind of fairly well off. He's not actually going into whatever it is that's troubling him.
Self-satisfied charity, isn't it?
Smugness
is very
going on there, yeah. So that also references the web of religion, I think. These things at the side here reference the web of religion. And here, I've said before, the Kraken awakes. So in Freudian terms, the undifferentiated unconscious is the id, and the id is then beginning to move. This is when he's full on in using now. This is Satan. It's that, so like Job, like Jung, Blake has a quaternary. There's a four is complete. So it's a complete attack by Satan. The door of death appears earlier on, but you're beginning to see the door of death again. That's the place of change, that moving through from one life to the other. In the beginning of Jerusalem, there's an image of a man with a light walking in through the door. That's the door of death. And then the druid, he gave the druids a bad press because he'd been reading too much Julius Caesar, but that was of his time. We seem to think a little more differently now. So these are druidic altars of human sacrifice. I think it's important to say that, I mean, he is off his time, Blake, but he carries a feminine principle through this. In the original Job myth, or Job's story, Job loses his wife, but Blake carries Job's wife all the way through with him. The transformation is between the two of them, and it's held together. I believe that's referential to the whole process that he experienced between him and Catherine. I think
The female's really major in Blake's work throughout, so that in the 2000 line poem Milton has to return to Earth to claim his feminine half.
Yeah.
Because he's been such a bastard to his three wives and three daughters. And it's very much derived from Sophia, the Gnostic sense of the female portion of God, Sophia or wisdom. So it persists. Jerusalem is a city and a woman.
Yes.
And absolutely crucial to the whole of Blake's myth. So there's real balance of gender there in many ways.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think I didn't make enough of it in the book, but...
It's a marvellous book, Jason.
I wasn't searching for it.
You don't have to apologise for any aspect of it. It's amazing.
But I'll look for one later. This is Lust, is what the image is supposed to... or Andrew Solomon points in that direction. You'll notice, which is interesting to me because I did quite a lot of Qigong, that the 2 feet, one on the knees in Blake are about contraction, which is what we're in the process of, contraction before expansion and growth and new becoming. And the others on in my Qigong practice is called the Dantian, but in Zen Buddhist it's the Hara. It's the seat of energy in the Eastern traditions where you draw the energy from heaven and earth together here and then distribute it around the body.
We may have to speed up a bit. It's okay, a challenge because there's 22 plates.
It's all right.
Same as the tarot, 22.
So we're at the quick bit. Nobody likes this bit. Now we're into Ulro. This is, have I got these out of order? This is, what did I say? This is, Ulro. Spiritual blindness. The comforters turn up. It's all very bleak. We're completely disconnected from Yahweh. There's a load of the altars of the human sacrifice. This point, there's a real tension between Job and his wife. She's moved to the right. She's on the left all the way through. She's moved to the right. And Job is, this is the first death, as it were. It's not the whole death for Job, but it's a big letting go. Everything's horrible. This is the point of using when you're just stuck on your own in your flat, going out, getting smacked and more. And it's just horrible. Really horrible. And the comforters have turned up to tell you, it's all your fault. I wish I were dead. So the 12 steppers would call this rock bottom. And you bounce along the bottom, I think, for some time. You can bounce along the bottom for 20 years. The people at Kor were an average of 11 years. So we get people who had been, had a proper habit. I mean, any habit is a proper habit, but, they'd been bang at it. And we get some people who are quick. You have to go to the point of to where we get to at the end of these few plates. Basically, I used to describe it as the cliff of death. And you're perfectly welcome to do that, but I'm not coming with you. Now we can walk back and try and find something else. That moment is extraordinary when you get someone to make that choice. It comes in a minute, but it can take forever to get there. And so I'll take that in questions, but we can talk about how and why, what that might be. This is Cheap Trick. So Fires, who's this guy here, has a dream that Job, who has inspired hair whenever you're truly inspired in Blake, apparently you have a punk haircut, and he's seen Yahweh saying, it's all your fault. Job, on the other hand, is saying, not entirely convinced. Anyway, we're still in the forest of error. The forest of error is the rational materialist, urizenic belief that you can do this through reason rather than, in fact, the truth is revealed. You're not going to work your life out. You can create space for a new life, a new symbol to emerge into. That's both an internal and, I think, a group and community process, and is the primary thing I'm trying to argue in the book.
Blake had a punk haircut when Catherine Blake first met him. She described him as having, it was like he had red hair, it was like red flames flickering out of his, head. Yeah. Love at first sight.
I believe it was, yeah. So, I mean, this one, shame. The just upright man was laughed to scorn. I sometimes say this is, I'm sure, how Blake felt from time to time. Rather too many pointy fingers. These chains are dragging, these are angels of protective angels dragging them into hell. This is an eagle, this is an owl. And I've been to see the plates, the actual copper plates, and you can see that the work is astounding. The individual tears that Job is weeping, can't see them on this. And there's a story to tell about why I'm using these, but probably not time. All the way down here, there's tears. It's real, really, really purgatorial place. Then we have this one, which you'll have come across before, which is affrighted with dreams. So Job is now having dreams that he's going to get destroyed. So the new symbol is near, but the psyche is not entirely sure, or the ego is not entirely sure how it can hold together. The way I usually describe that is that the ego is an elastic thing. Some of the stuff inside that needs to come to the surface is quite big. Our job is to make, strengthen, but not rigidify the ego, is to allow it to be able to, it's like a birthing image, allow the new symbol to come to the surface. So he's seeing this, but the clue that Blake gives, so here's the serpent, here's Yahweh, here's your inspired hair. He's pointing to the tablets of stone. I think in the next image, no, we don't have it there. It's pointing to tablets of stone. They're slightly clearer on the watercolors, which are the Mosaic law, the rigid rules, aren't the answer. If you just lit, like at the beginning of this, Job is living by the rigid rules, by the dogma, they aren't the answer. That needs to be poetic. For me, that's true. Our life is paradoxical and poetic. The point that I'm making, which is more Bohmian than Jungian, is that we are both all of it and the one moment at the same time. And the paradox is, how do we live that? Rationally, you can't, because it is unreasonable. But an unfolding revealedness about how metaphorical, poetic revealedness about how life is, can be becoming close to that, bearing that, is what we understand, I think, as healing. So as I sit in a room with a group of people or an individual, I'm sitting there trying to allow space into which something emerges, which is, to my mind, creative. I go with Whitehead and Bohm, who say that the root ethic in our life, in living, is creativity. The universe is a creative thing. And so all I'm doing is holding that space intersubjectively. So between two subjects, not a subject and an object. So we are both, or all of us, the whole thing and our individual expression of them at the same time. But you can't have one without the other. If we were just all the whole thing, we'd be sitting there in a state of bliss, but doing nothing. And we're all kind of fairly busy, so we'd like to do stuff, a lot of lovely stuff to do. So that idea is at the root of the book. If we carry on with that in an exploitative form and forget that the infinitude that is unknowable underneath it, we're in trouble. If we can see that as some kind of resonant thing, that the conscious bit is resonant with a moving whole, we're probably less so.
Got the hoof.
That's it here. There's the cloven hoof. So it's Satan, sorry. So this is the key change. This guy shows up. His name's Elihu. You can see he's in a call, so he's partly in and out. Poor Mrs. Job is like, just for God's sake, what she's carrying. So the first big death, the persona is let go of the addict. First idea of the addict dies. These are seen as dreams going up to heaven. There's a Jewish reference here. This is Orion and Pleiades. The Jewish and the Christian Kabbalah viewed in an opposite perspective. In a couple of plates time, he reverses that. So that's an interesting reference. And Elihu's saying he's both pointing transcendently and imminently, I think. Job is done. He's like, I've had enough of this. This is the moment where when they've actually get it, that they've got to stop and they've had enough. And instead of relating to the dead object of the whatever it is that they're using, they turn and relate to another human being. The point about the dead object, the smack or the speed or the TV or the food or whatever, is it gives the pastiche of relating back to you. It alters your feelings, but it doesn't really relate back to you, you know. Yeah. In which, symbolically, is that relationship between the particular and the whole, that we're all part of the same thing but also individual in it. It's difficult because it's paradoxical, but I do believe it to be true. I'm getting a rush. It's all right. Then God comes back, a bit of a storm. Then everything is in order. So this is the angels in heaven singing for joy. You've got the same Platonic order. This could be seen as Plato's Crave. All Ro is stable in the bottom. There's Sola Luna, and Yahweh is beginning to show Job what he's created. Here's the two different watercolor versions. Then this is really interesting, Plate. This makes it ecological. So here he's saying, but you're all right, but Behemoth and Leviathan, i.e. the whole thing, is better. This is my better creation. How do we fit with, in that sense, the divine and material creation together, holding the balance between the two? For me, this makes it ecological.
That's your yin yang.
Yin yang. So this is the but version, and that's the and that one's on the cover of the book. That's why I put it on the cover of the book. That's the Lionel version. So then we get to the second death and the main one. So this is the point where it begins to become. So up until that point, it's material. You can stop at that point and stay in just a new life. Then it becomes, I think, spirit, much more spiritual thing, although one would say it is all the way. Satan falls. The ego is let go of. This is the specter of Yahweh. Here's the specter of Job and his wife being transformed in the transformative fire. Then you go to, now this is the internalization of God. This is the last time Yahweh shows up. I've heard thee with the hearing of the ear, and now see me with the eye. Here, I think this is the Shekinah, this is Sophia, all incorporated in the one being which is standing now between heaven and earth. So my Qigong practice is that you stand between heaven and earth and you bring the Qi together in yourself and move. It's a healing practice. It's very powerful. Blake puts himself in this place. So there's his graving tool and his paints. So if you look at this as a hero's journey, you are exiled for a community, go through an encounter with death and come back to community. This is the point where of the return to community. You can't see it here, but there's an earring. There's actually an earring in the Job story in the Bible. That's a classic quaternary. You have the inspired hair. These are lovers around it. So instead of it now being love, lust, it's true connection. And Job and his wife are received and receive back into the community, which is my idea about reception. Then you get transmission. So I steal that from a Buddhist term. This is where these are his Job's daughters. They could be the three graces. They could be the daughters of Beulah. He tells the whole story. There's the interconnected vine. And then we move to, this is an extraordinary plate. It's like the whole thing crammed together. And then you get, they're all singing, dancing at the end. And connected, relating, playing music. The sheep have woken up. God says, I'm not interested really in burnt offerings. I'm not really interested in this suffering. Unfortunately, it seems to be part of the process. And I'm afraid that it's a cyclic model, so you start again.
So we end with a massive jam session. And they're all And I'd always thought of Job sort of very alone with his persecution by Satan, but in Blake's version, one of your clients pointed out, he's not alone.
That's slightly unfair. No, yeah. He's a very senior group analyst, and he's one of my colleagues.
I see, he was a colleague.
So I run a practice of about 90 therapists in London. And when I was pulling a board of people together to help me run it, I used these images as a way of working through the process. And the guy's name is Ian Simpson. He used to run the department at St. Thomas's, which is a big teaching hospital opposite the Houses of Parliament. He said, yeah, the thing I notice is Job's never alone. It's a group process. Yeah. He never says a lot. He usually says the right thing. But he's had a lot of practice.
And as you pointed out, his wife is very, very present in each plate.
Yeah.
Except they're the one with, it's just him and Satan.
Yeah.
Yeah. How extraordinary. Jason, that's such an extraordinary journey you've taken us through. And this is Blake's final completed work. He does go on to do hundreds of beautiful pictures for Dante's Inferno. Mm-hmm. Doesn't get further than the Inferno. And of course, dies singing, and he's still working on those. But that, I think, is not just anecdotal. He died singing.
Well, I think he saw, you see where you're going.
Yeah.
You know, and he will have done.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. He said he saw death as no more than removing to another room.
Yes.
It's lovely. Questions. We've got time for a few questions. Yes.
Why did you choose that career?
Why did I choose this career? So I was off my head when I was... There's the book. I was off my head when I was an adolescent. So I thought, started reading Freud and Jung. I'm not sure I held the books the right way up. I thought, I'll do that. So I started to get ready to train as a psychiatrist. Then I changed schools, and to compete with the people who were in the school I was at before, I produced and directed a play. And I thought, I can do all this, and I don't have to read these books, and I'm quite dyslexic, so reading a book's hard work. So I then went into the theatre, and that I was not a good enough narcissist quite to cope in the theatre. So I came back and started running the rehab I ran and trained as a psychotherapist. So I've wanted to do this since I was a kid.
Your plates in the book.
It's all in the book, yeah.
Right. The other question I want to ask you, you said that you didn't have much information about the Gnostics.
Yeah.
I thought that Yahweh was the demigod, and there was something above him.
All right.
So God is, which one is it?
Okay, so let's do it this way. Hold on this one. There we go. So that, if we look at this Kabbalistically, because I couldn't get it all in. Could have put the Gnostics in. That's Ein Sof. That's all and everything. Okay. So you can then look at Yahweh as the demiurge, or you could look at Satan as the demiurge. It depends on how you do it. So this plate's in the book, and how I talk about it's in the book. Yeah, please do. I don't know how much they're selling them for. It's off the cover price is about 30 quid, I think.
It is. It's Routledge. Yeah. They're always a little bit pricey. You can get it on Amazon. Waterstones here should be stocking it.
Yeah.
And it's worth every penny.
Here you go. You can have that one. Yeah. No, have it. Not at all.
Questioner here? Yeah, sorry.
Do you think there is a frequency of addiction, and how far has resonant frequency and frequency healing, how far has that affected the work you've done?
That's an interesting thing. So I don't technically know how to answer your question, but I do know that we used to do a lot of sound bowls, and that helped people change a lot. That's quite dark. When you're in that place, it's quite dark, it's quite dead, it's quite resonantly deadly. And what the sound bowls used to do would be align people's internal world so that they could begin to be able to support themselves. My view is that it takes a group to hold an addict. You need to do it on a communal basis. So my job, and I write about this in the book, was to hold the community, and it was the community that allowed the change to take place. And that is resonant. Where you pitch yourself in that around particular resonant frequencies, I'm not technically in a position to answer, except for, you know, you do feel a difference as you move up and down. I'm quite interested in the 14 chakra ideas rather than just the 7 that are in the body.
Tibetan singing bowls.
Yeah, yeah, no, this big. There's a whole load of quartz ones that I think are a byproduct of the
computer. They actually resonate, don't they? I've got four small ones.
That's just wonderful.
I used to use it in drama workshops.
But also brings the most extraordinary things up, you know. So we used to do them at CORE and do, you know, we do the practices with the staff as well and as a group. And the extraordinary stuff would come to the surface, both imaginally and dynamically, but just physically in the body. It would be painful.
Fantastic. There's a question from the back there.
I when I was a kid, I used to go to Sunday school. My my dad introduced me to the story of Job. He pondered, why would someone introduce hardship into anyone's life?
Yeah.
And it often made me wonder, is hardship and suffering an inevitability in our lives? And if it is, how regularly do we need to kind of contemplate that? And how do we heal if that's an inevitability?
So I wouldn't have the hubris to have an answer to that question, but it is where we get brought up against those struggles. So the way I used to describe it at CORE is that the pain draws your attention to where it is you need to be paying attention. So then you begin to think about how you allow, in my terms, the space for something to change. And in terms of the way that I'm describing it from a symbolic point of view, that you begin to be able to let go of a symbol that's no longer working for you and allow for a new one to arise. But there's all sorts of anxieties and fears that are really quite well articulated in this that come to the surface. And my view is that is now being returned to in a very group process, not so much. We've been, you know, the self is now very 20th century. We've been through, I'm an individual operating on the world. We can't do that. It's been quite successful. There's now a lot of us. We have to find a way of that being, that I'm an individual coherent with a process in the world. How do I find a way to balance that sense of individuality and the community sense that it's embedded in?
One of my favorite Blake lines is just one line from Jerusalem, and it's, cannot man live without mysterious offering of self one for another. It's just such an extraordinary line. It's a question from over here.
I wanted to ask you about the times we're living in. You touched on this a little bit. And obviously, you know, we all know we're facing ecological disaster. We're facing the destruction of our own species. Yeah. Everything's changing. Nothing's changing. How do we cope within that framework? Yeah, is my question.
We'll make that the last question. Hopefully not the last question.
There's a man who appears in this book who I worked with for 18 years. He's now become a colleague during that. You tend to work with someone that long when they train as well. And he practiced a thing called surrender yoga, which is that you just give up. Sit in a room, give up to whatever you think it is that's authentically coherent. It's an Indian tradition, but there's a god that you give up to. And he said, but mostly I practice no surrender yoga, and I think we're pretty much in that place. I think the only answer to where we are is a matter of surrender, but surrendering of selfhood in the way that you're describing. I talk about from a resonance of exploitation to a resonance, to a consciousness of exploitation to a consciousness of resonance. That resonance is rooted in a Whiteheadian idea, which is that power isn't like Aristotelian power of the unmoved mover, that I exert power on you. It's actually much greater to have the power to receive. How can I bear and open a space into which our co-creative, intersubjective, in Jessica Benjamin's term, life, can be found? It's in that kind of a place that the solutions to ecological struggles. We don't have a planet. That's part of the point of writing the book. We can't continue to exploit the planet as a load of selves. But together we can receive the whole thing into prep, but we have to overcome a lot of essentially narcissistic problems in order to be able to do that.
Well, I think we better make that the last question. Okay. I was just going to say, Albion says that line in Jerusalem. He has to try to save his friend, Los, the figure for the imagination. He says that line and then jumps into the furnaces of affliction, which turn into fountains of living water. Yeah. So perhaps the earth can be...
I think that paradox is true. Yeah. When it's in that moment when an addict chooses to actually relate. So the other thing that I haven't said is I think we are... addiction is at the root of that. We are all addicted. Technically, I think we're addicted to rational materialism, but it's it's in that process where you just look up and relate to another human being that co-created, and behind that other human being is the whole planet, you know, that some different choice is made, is possible.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jason Wright, his wonderful work and his wonderful book.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.